Welcome to the Multiple Sources podcast, where we discuss politics, religion, culture, and trauma, and how they all intersect. My name is Dr. Quincy Gideon, and I'm a clinical psychologist and one of the hosts of the show. We take on some really big and potentially triggering topics in this show. If you have a trauma history, please take very good care of yourself if you find yourself triggered. And remember, there's no assumed patient-therapist relationship by virtue of you listening to this podcast or contacting this show. We really are so glad that you are here. It would mean so much to us if you would subscribe to our show and give us a 5-star review so that others like you might find us. Thank you for being with us and supporting us. Let's jump in.
You are listening to the Multiple Sources podcast. I am Dr. Gregory Allen Thornbury, philosopher, biographer, and rockabilly guitar player, and I am joined by my co-hosts.
I'm Jazz Robertson, musician, dabbler, and resident historian.
And I'm Quincy Gideon. I'm a clinical psychologist and a religious trauma expert.
We're very excited to have with us on the show today one of my favorite prophetesses in the arena of both Instagram and Twitter, someone who, if ever there was an Oxford English Dictionary definition with a picture next to it of speaking truth to power, it is our guest today, Stephanie Drury, who, as you will learn today, has gone toe-to-toe and blow-to-blow with some of the biggest and baddest boys in evangelicalism, I think it's safe to say, and has lived to tell the tale. Stephanie, welcome to Multiple Sources. We're so glad to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
We want to go back to the origin story. Every superhero, you're a superhero. I think I saw at one point a photograph of you side by side with Gillian Anderson holding up an FBI, identity card.
And
maybe you're a superhero in the cast of Scully from the X-Files, but I've never seen you with a cape on, but you definitely seem to be levitating a lot of the time. And every superhero has an
Calm
origin
down, Greg.
Story. Every superhero has an origin story, and I think yours is one that that really does sort of fit the mold of this podcast, which is every week we talk about some aspect of how religious communities traumatize often the people who are a part of them and people that come out of them. Would you feel comfortable telling us a little bit about your background, your biography, how you grew up, where you grew up, and circumstances? Church-wise?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Arkansas, Fayetteville, Arkansas, because my parents are with the Navigators, which is a ministry that is adjacent to Campus Crusade for Christ, started by Billy Graham in like the 60s, I want to say. And my parents were with, call it like the collegiate ministry. My dad is an ordained Southern Baptist minister. And we just grew up going to church, our lives were like, lived and breathed like God. And looking back, I kind of think it was a bit culty. The Navigators was sort of, mm-hmm. I think the Southern Baptists, I think all that stuff it's got culty elements because the conditions are like, you believe this or you're out, it's pretty conditional.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. That's all I knew kind of growing up. I ended up going to the University of Arkansas. I didn't go to any Christian colleges, transferred to Southwest Texas State in the middle somewhere, graduated from there. But the whole time my parents had met through the Navigators. They got saved in the Jesus movement in the late 60s. And they got saved through the Navigators and met somehow, like at a conference in Virginia, and got married. And all we were Navigators. And people would say things like, what does your dad do? And you guys, your house is like kind of nice. And I'm like, I know, I'm not really sure what they do. They just have a lot of Bible studies and they like meet with students and pray all the time. And we just always had people coming through for prayer meetings, and, you know, church was mandatory. I hated youth group. Like, I would throw the most giant tantrums, scream, cry, pull out my hair, kick the wall, you know, when they try to make me go to youth group. But I didn't hate God. I felt like God and I had a thing that they weren't in on. Like, I felt like early on, somehow I intuited, or by some kind of providential situation, I received some sort of knowledge, word of knowledge, you might say, that, okay, what these people are doing isn't really what I'm on about. You know, what you're seeing is not based in grace at all. There's like no real love there is kind of what I remember from a pretty early age. And that really sustained me to be able to go, this doesn't really line up, but you have no choice.
What an incredible wisdom that you had so early on. I mean, it seems like quite a protective factor.
Yes.
In kind of protecting you against what could have become really abusive and fear-filled and everything that it becomes for people.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't escape that part of it, but I did have this special kind of presence I just felt like God and I were copacetic on some level, that he was being grossly misrepresented and there was nothing I could say to get them to understand. I don't know. That's just kind of where I remain. I don't want a job having anything to do with the church. I think growing up as a preacher's kid will either force you down that career path or make you run screaming. I'm super interested in it. It's all I think about is God and theology and how wankery theology is and what's underneath it. That's the beautiful truth and the desert mothers and even, apparitions and all that mysticism. I'm super into that. That's my main interest. So I just can't, I'm not called to make any sort of my living off of it. I want to keep that very separate, because then I feel a conflict of interest can arise too easily. Not for everybody, but
I'm reminded that I chose as my mug tonight the Kieran Kilgar, my favorite murder mug that says, "You're in a cult, call your dad."
She's my favorite comedian. I love her. You're in a cult, call your dad. See, she has a good Catholic dad who like prays to a certain saint of comedians for her. And I don't want to defend him as a perfect dad, but she's also had a lot of therapy and she can call bullshit. And I really like her perspective.
So if youth group was terrible and traumatizing, and you eventually make your way to, you know, state university in Texas somewhere, what happens next?
You know, I did stuff like I would go to Campus Crusade for Christ, and I was, cause it was like the language I knew, but I was still also like, fuck y'all about it. There was something about it that really rubbed me wrong, but I was really drawn to it because those were still my people. Cause I did believe in God, but I'm like, these Christians drive me insane. It was Christian culture. So just the specific evangelical culture, that wasn't really a name for it at the time. Now it's evangelicalism. So back then I there was the conflict, like, oh, the drinking conflict, and oh, it's so cliche to be a preacher's kid and drink. So I'm just not going to drink, but that's my rebellion. You know, that's how I'll rebel, is by not doing this stuff, by, you know, believing in God and not drinking, but also just being mad. And yeah, I wish I'd gotten into therapy then. It would have really helped. I didn't come into any therapy until mid-2000s. Yeah.
So it sounds like you're dancing.
I think so.
In between worlds, right? You had a lot of feelings about it, but it was still the people that were your people at the time. And then what?
And then what? Let's see. Graduated college, met my husband. The way we met was on AOL 2.0 in 1998. Are you ready for this? Okay. I'd moved back home. Ready. My parents were living in Wichita Falls, Texas at this time, which is the most horrible place on the continent. It's like absolutely the very worst. Are you familiar with Wichita Falls?
Oh yeah. I grew up in Texas. My dad coached in Mundy, Texas, which was 75 minutes from Wichita Falls. And that was the only Walmart that we had.
It was so exciting. People drive from literally 200 miles away from the Supercenter Walmart. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh my goodness. So you understand. So I'm stuck. I just had this horrible breakup down in Austin, and to get away from him, I'm like, I'm going to have to move back home. And like, after living on your own for 4 years and moving back home, you're like, fuck. And it was the worst. But AOL appeared in the disc, you know, everyone got the disc AOL. And I'm like, this is like my little Narnia door.
At the Super Walmart.
When I'm not the Super Walmart or at the DQ, I can figure out with this internet thing that you plug into the wall. And so figuring out the algorithm where you can meet people. Oh my gosh, people like OK Computer just come out. I'm like, oh, who likes Radiohead? You know, like find like the Vin, and then a bunch of idiots like Radiohead. Okay, who likes C.S. Lewis? Oh, a bunch of idiots like C.S. Lewis. Venn diagram, like put both of those in there. Okay, maybe I can meet some cool people this way. And my husband David had just graduated from Regent College up in Vancouver, BC. Gotten his master's in Christian studies up there. He's also a preacher's kid. And his name came up and we just like really meshed and liked all the same stuff. He sent me his master's thesis, which was a novel, a children's novel. And I'm like, I need to marry this guy. And that was a total secret. It was a secret. But it was pretty great how that worked out because we were deconstructing, but we didn't know the word for it at the time. And we're just something about the way we grew up resonated and then so much did not. And so we got married within a year and moved to Seattle just to start over, start new. And so we've been here for like 25 years. So the journey through that has been both of my siblings went to therapy and when we started setting boundaries with our parents, they were super mad, you know, which is to be expected. But when each of us asked our parents to go to therapy with us, their response was to disown us, say, we're never talking to you again. It's like all three of us, like separately over a year, each of us.
Never talk to you again?
Yeah. So I have, you know, it's been, that was in 2005. And, I hit like this emotional bottom where I absolutely had to get some professional help. And I actually got a really good therapist and I've had really bad therapy and I've had really good therapy. I'm so grateful that I got the therapist I did who was informed in religious trauma. She went to the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology here in Seattle, Dan Allender. Mm-hmm. I really have love a lot of the stuff he says, and I find it so helpful. So, anyway, dealing with her, I was able to set boundaries and figure out, she's like, you've always known that you've been capable of being that they were capable of this. And now it's just come into reality and you're forced to deal with it in, your consciousness instead of your subconscious. So I was deconstructing and I, started Stuff Christian Culture Likes. It was a blog at the time. I had some atheist friends who were asking around the time of the election, oh, who was it? McCain and Palin, like that ticket. Who was it? Biden? Yeah. Who was? I can't even remember now who was the Democratic. It was Obama. Biden. Okay, sorry. Sorry, because we were on this big long road trip. My atheist friends were like, why do all the Christians like this warmonging warmongering criminal. And I'm like, oh, I can tell you exactly why. And they're like, geez, you know so much about this. And I'm like, yeah, I really do. Like, you should start a blog because blogs are sort of new then. So I'm like, all right. And the book Stuff White People Like had just come out. And I'm like, well, Stuff Christian Culture Likes. Like, I didn't want to call it Stuff Christians Like because I wanted to distinguish between the culture around evangelical mm-hmm. Christianity. Now I would call it Stuff Evangelicals Like. But at the time, I'm like, this is what I'm going to call it, Stuff Christian Culture Likes. And I just like kind of my deconstruction just walked it out in blog form and started a Twitter and Facebook page, and people just kind of came on board, and I didn't really know I was deconstructing at the time, but it's pretty much what I was doing. So yeah, mm-hmm. it was really helpful to find other people, online community, just know you're not alone in going through that. And I really feel now that the worst part of processing any trauma is the part where you feel like you're isolated and you're alone in it. And if you can have anyone yep. identify and say, that resonates for me, that happened to me too, or at least I'm here, I empathize, like that, you can get through anything, I really feel.
Hmm. Yeah, trauma is the experience of unbearable feelings that are only made worse in isolation. Mm-hmm. So the number one protective factor against a one-time or a collection of traumatic events turning into a long-term issue or an identity issue or self-esteem issue is support, a support system. That's the number one mm-hmm. thing that can prevent these long-term pathologies that happen. Yeah. So I think you're articulating something that science is like, yes, that's right on the money. Feelings feel worse when you're isolated, and trauma continues when people are alone.
Yes, absolutely. And it just helped me so much because growing up without an empathetic ear, just to be able to change my parenting. And I'm so mm-hmm. grateful to have had that tragedy happen when my kids were so little, because I really feel like I would have unwittingly passed my stuff on to them. But this way I feel like I was able mm-hmm. to break the cycle in a lot of major ways, and that they're just not going to deal with the stuff that I did. But I really do believe in generational trauma mm-hmm. and that stuff just getting passed down.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie, absolutely. Can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. Apologies if this is horribly personal and can say fucking absolutely not. But whenever you talk about boundaries, and this is something I think a lot of, at least speaking for myself, you find with people that you love, finding those boundaries around the political and religious weirdness that they'd like to bring into their interactions with you. Is that what you're referring to when you talk about these boundaries that you were trying to establish with your parents and that they just weren't having it? Can you say more about that?
Yeah, my specific boundary with them, and I'll say this too, it took me like many months for my therapist to convince me that I deserved to set boundaries with my parents. I did not, this was so foreign to me, it was not allowed. But it was really the only boundary that I set was to say to my parents, I really want a relationship with you. And in order to have that, you can't shame me. Hmm. I can't always be on guard for whatever you're going to say that will just cut me to the quick. So I can't have you criticizing these little things about me, you know, just things I did a long time ago. Just no. And they just were not willing to do that.
That's just not unreasonable to ask someone to not be a dick. Like, mm-mm. I just don't.
It's just bare minimum. Being decent, right? Bare. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I really think that my parents, and I'm only saying this because I think a lot of people will also be able to identify with it, is a lot of people have kids to offload their mm-hmm. shame. I really think that mm-hmm. that is just an unconscious, unwitting mechanism. And it starts young. I think it starts in utero. Like mm-hmm. Quincy, I'm sure knows mm-hmm. tons about that. So I think that it really did make them think, well, what good are you to mm-hmm. me then if I can't hurt your feelings mm-hmm. and then release some tension in myself?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Thank you for mm-hmm. answering that.
I think what you're talking about is sort of the intersection of a lot of different pieces of shit that come with religious trauma, which is we are all individuals walking through the world with a collection of stories, with a history that might be traumatic. And maybe that was our ancestors' trauma that's been passed on in the ways that they behaved with us. And then that teaches us how we behave with ourselves and with others. So there's kind of like that individual trauma history, that intergenerational trauma that can perpetuate in humans and be a very unconscious thing. And then people drag God into that, or they drag religion into that. And it becomes sort of this like confirmation bias. Like if they can find some message that confirms the shame that they need to offload on their children, or confirms the practice of something that's actually quite unhealthy, then they'll do it. Because now they've got a God or a pastor or a church or some powerful leader that is giving that the go-ahead, that's sort of blessing that behavior. And then therefore, I think people feel when they are participating in these processes, they feel right. They feel like there is no shame in what we've done. We've done the right thing, underlined, put in bold with an exclamation mark. We've done the right thing, and now you have to go deal with whatever you have to deal with. It's a really terrible process.
I mean, this is all enmeshed in the ecclesiastical and governing church documents and covenants, in specifically Baptist and congregational type churches. The thing you mentioned, that your parents were Southern Baptists, the thing that Southern Baptists in the, well, really throughout their history, but particularly in the 19th century in the South, prided themselves on was these church covenants, and it was the church that was your actual family. Mm. And that people had to believe and subscribe and obey and toe the line if they wanted to be in the church family. And the example of this par excellence is that when church discipline would happen, which was by far the favorite activity of Southern Baptist churches in the 19th century, it fell out of favor, and now it has come back with a vengeance. Church discipline now is, you know, the new favorite pastime of many, many Baptist churches, and you would discipline a member of the church by saying, we're putting you outside of the community, and I'm no longer calling you a brother. You're now just a friend. You're just like any other neighbor in the community. And it's not just something that accidentally happened in these church communities. It was on purpose that was interpreted from certain passages in the New Testament. And it has very, very deep roots. And I'm so sorry that that happened to you.
Thank you. I mean, the freer I feel to talk openly about it, the more I feel like it needs to be talked about, because the shame keeps us silent and isolated. That's it's just a brilliant design of evil to silence you and keep you away from other people and where you can heal and actually experience actual love. So the more I talk about it, the better I feel about making a safer space for other people to possibly come forward and know that it's not your fault. It's not just you. No one deserves that to happen. It's incredibly violent. Mm-hmm. There's nothing more violent. Yeah,
it is. There's nothing more violent than causing someone to feel like their eternal future is on the line with how other people perceive them, how they're being judged by others.
Yeah.
Mm. So it's a miracle that you found your husband and that you're both soldiering on together in completely similar circumstances, it sounds like. So you find your way to Seattle, and are you attending church? Do you find community there? Was there a period of sort of Gandalfian, all who wander are not lost? And of course, where I'm going with this next is, at some point you become aware of a growing situation in the Seattle metropolitan area mm-hmm. called Mars Hill Church and the Acts 29 Church Planting Network. Walk us up to how you become aware of this phenomenon that, for listeners who don't know sort of contemporary evangelical pop culture for the past 20 years, this is something that made it to the cover of the New York Times magazine. This infamous figure who we shall now name, because we're not afraid of Voldemort, Mark Driscoll. How do you come out of that family trauma, you know, religious trauma from your family past, and then find yourself walking into a whole other situation of trauma? Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Well, I think that coming from church trauma makes it comfortable for you. When we moved here, some friends of ours were going to a church. Like, my husband had been in some bands, and they in down San Francisco, and there were people he knew from there that had moved here were going to this church called Grace Seattle, which was a PCA church, Presbyterian. So we started going there, and it started the same time Mars Hill did. So it was kind of like this dueling thing going on. And so I was always, that was always on the radar, because Mars Hill had rented out a venue. That's where they met, like in the U District, where their whole thing was, we're cool. And that made me like, that raised my hackles. I'm like, you know, this, if you have to try too hard, then this is reminding me of a youth group. So I didn't want anything to do with it. I love the liturgy of the Presbyterian church, because it was so much more, liturgical than anything I grew up with. Even though the PCA did not ordain women, that wasn't on my radar yet. I'm like, at least you let them speak and read scripture. That's so sweet of y'all. So that's where I was at the time with that. We were at that church for 12 years, and there was a lot of good things that happened at that church. That the pastor of that church set me up with my wonderful counselor. Like, he recommended her. So that was one of the good things that came from there. That pastor also offered to mediate between my parents and me, because they were cool with him, because he was a pastor. He saw the email, like, he was kind of like a stand-in dad in that way, as pastors should be, where he saw them say, we're never going to talk to you again, because you want us to go to therapy. So like, he bore witness to that and directed me to good therapy. Now that church ended extremely violently when they fired the music minister and just put him and his family on the street in the worst economy, because they drew up a new business plan. And I remember going before the board of elders several times. The session is what they're called in the PCA. The session, it's all dudes, you know? And they all would like, oh, such a bro-y vibe. Like, they were all like, ooh, we're the session. We're together. We're like, no women here. And they made the rules for everyone. And their wives are like, oh, I don't want to like do anything against God's will, so I'm just going to listen to my husband. And I'm like, what? So this was, after they fired this guy, it was on my radar, because I kept trying to meet with the session. And I was just this weeping woman going, how can you do this to your brother? Like, put him out on the street. This guy's been here forever. You know his kids. You've been in each other's houses for all these years, and you just decide you don't like his awesome music because you guys are fucking squares, and you just want to put him on the street, like, revise the business plan. So I'm just like bawling, and David would be right there, and they had these blank, stony stares. Assholes, you know? Mm-hmm. And then David would repeat what I said, and they'd look at him and go, oh, that makes sense. Oh, I like how you put that, David. And that, I had never seen the patriarchy. I didn't know I'd heard of it, but I'd never seen it like that. Scales fell from my eyes. And I remember a guy on the session when I said, the Holy Spirit is telling me something you've done is very wrong. They're like, the Holy Spirit is not telling you that. I go, okay, my intuition is telling me y'all have done something very violent to this music minister. And this guy, one of the church elders, said, Stephanie, your intuition is wrong. And somehow I just knew I have to go. The fact that you just said that to me, I'm out. Mm-hmm. That's all I needed. I just need to go. this guy was also like in conversion therapy and trying to convince himself that he wasn't gay. And that's, I just feel that, okay, this, bless his heart, he's like lived in denial all this life. And this is, so it makes sense to me now that
this
he would
is
say
another version
me.
Of it. Yeah.
So after that, I'm like, let's try out Mars Hill. Went to one, fuck this. Like from the stage, he said, I remember Mark Driscoll saying, if you, let's see, first of all, the sermon took an hour. He was very self-satisfied. Everyone was so creepily into what he was saying. It was like being at a Gothard seminar, which I grew up going to, which was terrible. But just hanging on to his every word. And then he said from the pulpit, if the husband wants to have sex with the lights on, that's what the wife should do. And I remember like the way everyone cheered and me thinking, how many sexual abuse survivors are in this room right now that are being incredibly damaged? Yeah. Like, what are you doing to these people by saying that? And that I just, so that was my first experience of Mark Driscoll in person.
Yo, like, what a weird and fucked up thing to say. Like, who the hell says that?
Yeah. And like, everyone was like, the term that comes to mind to me all the time about this stuff is manufactured consent. They manufactured the women's consent to be like, okay, I guess I'll do what he says. Okay, I guess, you know, and even the guys knew, I think that their consciences all knew something was wrong, but you're told this is spiritual authority. And so you don't push back, and they make it really uncomfortable when you push back. They do everything they can. It's like a John Grisham novel. Like everything that you try to do, they cut you off like at the knees.
Mm-hmm. Well, they, you know, when something like, sexual behavior in any way is spouted by an authority figure and God is dragged into it. So the message that at least part of the women in that congregation were hearing was, it is my godly duty in my marriage to participate in something that I don't want to do or that makes me feel uncomfortable. That is what God is requiring of me. And I think that is what is so sadistic about this stuff, is that there is, not only is God dragged into it, but women start fearing for what their futures might be, what God feels about them, because of these messages that are spouted.
Absolutely. And one of my good friends at the time was a midwife, and or I knew of her, now we're good friends, but she had this midwifery practice that she had all the Mars Hill business, she and her practice. And she told me, first of all, when I asked to see the woman alone, the husband, if it's a Mars Hill couple, the husband never wants to leave her alone. The wife will often say, I wish our fights didn't get so physical. And they would say, well, my husband is not allowed to masturbate, and so I'm not supposed to deny him sex. And so these women, these married so young, would just have these babies just every year, like come back. She's like, I had so many repeat customers. But at the same time, I was in some group, like groups where women who were members of Mars Hill had signed a covenant, and they were shaking. They're physically shaking, saying, I'm not supposed to be here because I signed a covenant, not even just a contract, a covenant, which implies eternal, you know, and very spiritual. This covenant says, I'm not supposed to have any counseling that isn't from Mars Hill, but I really am having suicidal, homicidal ideation. Started attending this church because it seemed good. Then I was pressured to get married, then pressured to quit my job, then pressured to have babies. And now like they were absolutely at the edge of their mental health because they were bearing the brunt of what Mars Hill taught. Those women and those children were innocent for the egos of men. It was so Handmaid's Tale. I cannot watch that series because it is so similar to what Mark Driscoll teaches. And what I don't even want to single out Mark Driscoll. I mean, it's across so many religions, but I just, I can't handle this progressive stance. I call it faux-gressive or brogressive, where they give every appearance of, oh, I voted for Biden. I did this. I, you know, I'm liberal. I hate guns. And My wife, though, like, she should definitely submit to me. And, you know, we would disown our children if they came out of the closet, you know, whatever. All that is absolutely there. So it's like kayfabe. It's 100% what's going on.
Yep.
So, again, for those of the uninitiated who are listening here, this is not a single church phenomenon in Seattle. This is, at some point, Mark Driscoll becomes so popular that they start doing multi-site churches where Mars Hill is now not just a single location, it's in multiple locations throughout Seattle. And then it becomes a national, it becomes a denomination, church denomination in and of itself. And in the, you know, late aughts and the early 2010s, Mark Driscoll was a prince among men in Calvinistic Reformed evangelicalism. He was highly regarded. He was platformed by magazines like Christianity Today and organizations like Tim Keller's The Gospel Coalition. And without any theological education to speak of, was being promoted as this sort of theological savant. And it becomes a national phenomenon. And these attitudes, practices, ecclesiastical ordinances, theological dicta become mirrored at all of the mini-me bros, as you call them, or we referenced you in a previous episode, Stephanie. I like that you call them theolabros, not just theobros, but theolabros.
I didn't make that up. I don't know who did, but I can't take credit.
I'm giving you credit for it. I wouldn't know about it if it weren't for you. But it becomes then this this national phenomenon that is being mirrored in places like Louisville, Kentucky, and in Los Angeles and everywhere. And you know, cutting to the sort of like the tail of the tape and then reversing back, this all explodes. It implodes. And can you talk a little bit about the implosion of Mars Hill Church and your own role in that, Stephanie? Because this was widely reported upon by the news media in Seattle. You had a large role in bringing these abuses to light. So could you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yeah, because I was getting protected stories from women who were in danger. I was like, what can I possibly do to get it out there that how dangerous this thinking is? And so I started a Twitter that I called Fake Driscoll, at Fake Driscoll. And probably it must have been 2008 or 9. And during my commute, I would just tweet on the way in and the way out. And I would just say that, like, I'd heard from someone who went to Mars Hill. They're like, we were at Grace Driscoll's birthday party, and Mark Driscoll stood up and asked Grace, what are your goals for the next year? What do you want to weigh in 1 month? What do you want to weigh in 2 months? And so I would tweet things like, guys, we need your prayer. Tomorrow's Grace's weigh-in. And she's been hitting the treadmill, though, so I feel pretty good about the numbers we're going to see tomorrow. You know, just stuff. I tweet stuff like that. Like, I would listen to his sermons and, like, use his voice and just pretty much, though, say, like, shit he would say. And so that started to gain some steam. And my husband was part of a documentary he had been in, was going to be screened at Mars Hill. It was called Holy Rollers, the true story of Card Counting Christians. And so, because he plays professional blackjack. And so because there's a Christian angle Mars Hill thought was real cool. And so they were going to screen it at one of their campuses. And then right before the screening, like the day before, they found out that I was married to David and they disinvited him. They're like, because you're married to Stephanie Drury, you're not allowed on any Mars Hill campuses. And it was hilarious, the response of his blackjack Diallo bros, who were like, oh man, Stephanie, you need to be quiet. And like one of the guys yelled at David, why don't you control your wife, you know? Yeah, fuck that guy's that guy. But this is the thinking, you know, like I was a problem that should have been controlled. And just because I'm trying to name this stuff, so I just started just talking about Mark Driscoll every chance I got. And I guess my Steph Christian Culture Likes following on Facebook was like 15,000 at the time. So every time I'd talk about him, it would get out there. And in 2013, I think, 2013 or 14, it fully folded. And I had people from Acts 29 reach out and say, I just want you to know it was because of you and the social media onslaught that they just couldn't handle it anymore. Like he couldn't stay in Seattle. And so people like the stranger, I remember they wanted to quote me. They're like, so are you so excited Mars Hill folded? I'm like, no, he's just gonna go do it somewhere else. And he did.
Yeah. Yeah. The violence, I can't get over it. It's
so much worse. I mean, I could tell you, but you know, you've seen it all, you've heard it all, but yeah, this is just the tip of the iceberg.
You know, the wild thing with this Mars Hill saga is that, as it was previously noted, it was kind of its own denomination, so there was no accountability or recourse, right? I mean, I'm not saying that large denominations do a great job of holding people accountable, far from it, as we've seen in recent months with the SBC, for example. But at least there's a mechanism whereby they can pretend to have standards and consequences for bad behavior. But instead, Mars Hill was like a traveling roadshow. It's not working here anymore. Let's just pack it up and go somewhere else, right? Like, dang.
And like the funding's there. Like he was able to raise so much money. Yeah.
I can't clinically diagnose him, but I'd like to, because I think it would be fascinating. But there's got to be something. I don't want to blame this all on mental health or mental illness, because I don't think that I think that that is a cop out, and I think that that's unfair to the people who really suffer from mental illness, mental instability, trauma, that sort of thing. But there are some personality structures that are going on here that absolutely went unchecked for a long time. And when there is like institutional power given, when there are numbers of people flooding in, when there is money, that ends up becoming like affirmation that they're doing the right thing. Or affirmation that they're on the right track.
God's blessing.
And that is so, yes, that is so dangerous, because just because money comes in does not mean that you're on the right track. It doesn't mean that you're doing the right thing. It could just mean that you are playing into the hand of patriarchy, of abuse, of over-sexualization of women, of whatever that is. Money comes in all different shapes and sizes and for all different reasons. That is not an indication that God is blessing you.
100%.
Well, it was the money in some respects that was part of his undoing, because he published a book, ironically enough, on marriage, and had the church buy 100,000 copies of the book so that he could make the New York Times bestseller list. And that was one of the threads that was pulled. That I mean, it was, and here's what I want to advance is really fucked up. It was that sort of thing that really began to. It would have been fine if he would have just continued to do everything and say everything that he was saying about women, because his buddies in the Gospel Coalition and Together for the Gospel, deep down, I think they all wished they could be Mark Driscoll. I mean, I remember that, you know, the sort of the chattering and the tittering classes of these bros, because I knew those people in a former life. They were like, oh, he uses swear words. That's what's so bad about Mark Driscoll. You know, he swears from the pulpit. Like, you know, that was the problem. And that he was, you know, indecorous, and that he had peccadilloes. There are all these euphemisms that people use to just, you know, make excuses for people like Mark Driscoll or Donald Trump. And but the reason why they succeed is because deep down, that's what, you know, pastors, white evangelical pastors, they wish that they could do the same thing. I mean, he was sort of out there as sort of like an anti-hero for these people, and he was played up that way for such a long time until you stepped into the picture, and many others, witnesses, you know, abuse survivors, rose up in a chorus, and especially in a city like Seattle, of all places, you know, it's the modern equivalent of run out of town on a rail. And so, speaking of ironies, here we are in the year of our Lord 2021. And there is a podcast that is published by Christianity Today that at one stage was, I think, in the top five most listened to podcasts in the country. And it's called, I guess it's still going, I think the interest has dropped off after initial fanfare, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. And Stephanie, you've had quite a few people advocating for you in this respect. Tell us a little bit about this podcast and what you know about it, and what was curious about this very popular podcast.
I haven't listened to it, but it was curious that the producer, Mike Cosper, is that his name, emailed me, I think in January, and asked me if I'd be interested in being on it. And I said yes. And then, and it was a couple months later, he tweeted something about how spiritual abuse survivors were being whiny and punching down at the church system when they were trying to call out their abuse. And so I replied to that and said, actually, no, it's very important to name abuse, and never followed up about being on the podcast. So that was, I mean, it's just one of those gut feelings you get. You're like, Christianity Today, I mean, I have no trust in them anyway. They platformed Mark Driscoll for years. And when I first heard they're doing a podcast, I'm like, this is going to be the stupidest, worst podcast ever. And everyone's going to love it because they're going to, there's something about the way evangelical publications are able to convince everyone to think that they're cool. And it's so embarrassing. It makes me not want to be a Christian at all, because you guys are fucking squares. Like, you fall for it every time. It's like Christianity Today is out here going, oh, they'll soak it up. Like the Babylon Bee, all these pieces of shit who claim to be like doing the Lord's work, they're doing the opposite. And like these morons who are progressive Christians, like, eat it up, sop it up with a biscuit. It's so embarrassing that they fall for it. I can't say enough about how embarrassing it is.
So you are one of the whistleblowers. You were the one that started this account that is like bringing about stories that cannot be told without women being in danger. You're doing all of that work that reaches some pinnacle, some like cascade point, and you are not invited to talk on the podcast about The Rise and the Fall Yeah. A fucking Mars Hill.
Well, yeah. I have to in the interest of public disclosure here. I mean, I know Mike Cosper. I've known him for years, and when I have the text message when he first reached out to me that he was going to do a podcast on the rise and fall of Mars Hill Church. He himself is somebody who is part of a sort of a toxic mega church situation himself. I mean, he was a founder planter of a church that had a, you know, I think it's fairly well known, had abuse, toxicity, spiritual authority abuse at the top. And so I told Mike, you know, do not pass go, do not collect $200 on moving forward with this podcast until you talk to Stephanie Drury. And I sent the Seattle Weekly article. I said, here is somebody that legitimately, from the eyes of the news media, is the change agent here. And it was sadly believable. I wish I could say the, you know, Princess and the Bride, inconceivable that that Stephanie would not be front and center of this. And yet was not.
Well, it's
and
just then, because they aren't interested in exposing the truth. Mm. They are trying to normalize mm-hmm. this abusive system and mm-hmm. under the guise of saying that Mark Driscoll failed. But all they're really saying from everything mm-hmm. I can infer is that he got caught. So don't get caught, y'all.
Yeah, I've listened to a few of the episodes just to have some context about what was going on here. And it was hard for me to get through because from the jump, from the like opening credits, Mike Cosper is saying something to the effect of, this is a story of religious abuse and overreach of power, something like that. And also God working in mysterious ways in this church. That is the opening credit. That is the tagline that is used in every single episode. And that to me is crawly. Like that makes my stomach hurt to think about the idea of this publication was, or this podcast was, to continue to try to ride two horses with one ass, to continue to like it be two places at once. It's either a story of abuse that was upheld by the powers and the structures that be, or it's a story of abuse that stopped immediately as soon as people reported it, and that is God working in mysterious ways.
I mean, every woman I know who went to Mars Hill is so triggered by the podcast that their mental health is declining since it came out. And all the guys are like, this is a great podcast. This is really well done. It just goes to show how they market to, like, people are sucked in and believe it, will not think for themselves. No empathy, you know, no awareness of power dynamics. I was trying to think of who it was. My friend Drew, who had gone to Mars Hill for a long time, sent a lot of audio files to Mike Cosper. This was back in like probably May or June. And then he asked, so he had this rapport going on with Mike Cosper. And then he said, Mike, why haven't you had Stephanie Drury on? And he sent me a screenshot of Mike's reply. And Mike said, well, she doesn't seem to have that much to do with the downfall of Mars Hill. First of all, she never went there. She didn't seem to have that much to do with it. And also her hostility, her vitriol, and frankly, her vulgarity are really off-putting. I mean, he might as well have called me hysterical. Like,
yeah, that's what it is. That's what it is.
It's because I was a woman, because he has all these abusive pastor figures, sound bites of them constantly, who have put their wives in the hospital. Just Google it. And they're not too hostile or vulgar. They're being bleeped. He doesn't care. That's not too vulgar. It's 100% a sexist issue. And they are trying to normalize this view of women to keep it going because they benefit. Why can't everyone see this? Well, it's so obvious.
Well, I think this is my question was, why is Christianity today, which I find to be incredibly boring, why is there a podcast that's like number four?
Well, this
in
is
the
a
US?
Very and I think clickable topic, like the way down, it, the vow, like all these cult documentaries are, they get a lot of traction. Mm.
But I think that people kept listening to it because the audience of Christianity today wants to see redemption in stories of abuse without accountability.
Oh yeah.
Right? Like that is the thing that perpetuates this stuff in these religious organizations, is that we want to be able to like talk about it, but we always have to put like a little bit of sunshine in it, a little bit of redemption, a little bit of how like we're going to make this all right somehow, or God has made this all right, because that is what the normal, in my opinion, Christian can tolerate. And so if they're not going to lose all of their subscribers and they are going to hit like records in a podcast, then they have to ride those two horses with one ass.
Exactly. I mean, I think,
well, it's also go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Stephanie.
No, I was just going to say, I think of the Desmond Tutu quote where he says, you have to name all the abuse. You cannot forgive and forget. You can forgive, but you must never forget, or the abuse will happen again. You have to name all the abuse, all the pain, everything they did, and what, and the effect that it had on you, or there can be no true forgiveness and reconciliation.
That's right.
Well, that's so true, but there is a commercial element of this for Christianity today. I mean, that podcast is the evangelical equivalent of a true crime podcast. Mm-hmm. And we all know how popular they are. There's mm-hmm. something titillating about it. And I mean, Christianity Today is a magazine that whose subscriber base has been dwindling for years. And as recently as this week, the publisher of Christianity Today sent out an email begging people to donate money because its business model, like a lot of magazines, but its business model is badly broken. But the top thing that is said, as you know, here is the evidence that we are still relevant, is the success of this podcast. So it's very much a feather in their cap that they can mm-hmm. monetize, we're going to do something other than what is our core mission in mm-hmm. order to find enough people that, you know, click on a podcast. And this shows that we are the go-to source for telling these stories. And it's like asking the wolf to guard the hen house, mm-hmm. is an appropriate analogy, but it is an economic mm-hmm. reality for them.
I think it might be a sign.
That's hilarious and delicious that they are asking for donations if they had such a popular podcast. That is sad. I mean, God's not blessing your ministry, Christianity Today, if you're having to dig for donations like this.
Gregory, you've said this in our podcast episode with David Dark on Kayfabe. You talked about how Kayfabe is oftentimes in the pursuit of business, in the pursuit of money. It is mm-hmm. we have to have these masks in order to continue on with the thing that actually makes us money. And for me, this podcast is that. It's the ultimate kayfabe. It's mm-hmm. the ultimate masking of the real problem, the real essential issue, in order to not lose your base, not lose the people that are like still hanging on as subscribers.
Yeah, absolutely. And a good analogy to this that's happening right now is that right now on television there are two different kinds of documentaries on wrestling. There are the documentaries that are produced by the World Wrestling Entertainment Organization that's owned by Vince McMahon. And so they will tell the story of these wrestlers, and it's done with like you know, super sanitized, Vaseline over the lens, really light brush, it won't go into the problematic issues. And then there's another separate from the World Wrestling Entertainment Organization documentary series called Dark Side of the Ring. And it shows the violence, the mental health issues, the incredibly, one of the recent issues was on the treatment of wrestlers, of airline attendants on a flight from London back to New York City. The World Wrestling League would never in a billion years tell that story. They don't want those stories to be told. They want their version of the story to be told. They want to tell just enough to titillate people and make people feel like they have, you know, heard a verisimilitude of truth. But they, you know, they don't talk about the body count. Mm-hmm. And I fear that that's what's happening here.
I agree.
So, Stephanie, I have one more question to ask you. And it is, it's related to the fact that for all that you have been through and all that you have seen and all of the, to use biblical language, the principalities and powers of this dark world that have been arrayed against you, as you've advocated for victims, you have a very, very deep, abiding, and active prayer life and faith. And do you mind telling our listeners what keeps you going every day and who keeps you going?
I have a thing for Mother Mary. I can't talk about her without crying, but as part of my job, as you know, doing risk analysis for a trauma center, when I started therapy, I began crying when I would read the cases at work, and I was like, oh shit, how do I get through my day now with this new development? And my therapist said, well, your shell is coming off. You've needed that protective shell to survive. And now you're safe and you're deconstructing that part and you don't need it anymore. So you're vulnerable. And every case I read just was so raw. I felt like it, I mean, I just, it was really, really tough to have to read all of the trauma that's out there and happening to these people who have no voice. So my hospital is near a Catholic cathedral. And on my lunch break, I started going in there. And I started to just write down like the cases that I saw, just not even the names, just what happened to that person. And on my lunch break, I would take it into the Catholic cathedral. Now you got to know that growing up Baptist, my parents would rather me have been an atheist than Catholic, you know? And so I felt like I was doing something very transgressive by even going into that cathedral, and it was scary. You know, like there's something about going into Catholic churches that's scary. They're spooky. There's something, you know, the statues, and it just feels like, woo. So, and now I think that's because of the presence of the Eucharist, the Blessed Sacrament. But I started going in there. I was just so compelled, even though it was so spooky. And I was drawn to the statues of Mary. And I'm like, well, she's a mother. And I had all the trepidation, the Baptist trepidation of, oh, you're praying to an idol, you know, Catholics worship Mary. And I kind of got the sense, no, they don't, you know, they just ask her to pray for them. And I had a Catholic friend who's a Methodist minister turned Catholic in Kentucky. And he messaged me one day and he goes, our mother came into my heart last night and told me to tell you that she hears you. And that just did it for me. And it's been really meaningful for me because I need a mom, and she has very much been a presence for me, and I can't explain it, and it probably makes me sound insane, but it's really the reason that I still have any faith at all. And I'm just so compelled every day to go to a Catholic church and be with the Blessed Sacrament. And I don't want to convert officially to Catholicism because I don't believe that women shouldn't be priests. I don't believe in their LGBTQ stance, but I love Mary and I love Jesus and I love just sitting. There's something very special to me about Catholic churches. So I pray the rosary almost every day. I'm a little addicted to it. It has done wonders for my mental health. And I know so many people will hear me and think that I sound absolutely batshit, but I have so much peace from it. And that's why I can't write this stuff off. I can't explain it and I can't write it off. And that's just where, that's the intersection where faith resides.
Thank you so much.
You don't sound crazy to me. You sound honest. And I think that that's the hard part of coming out of any religious trauma, is trying to be honest about where we still stand. What can we still believe in? What can we still honor in ourselves? It's the hardest part, and you're doing it.
Yeah, it's crazy, and I'm not going to claim to know anything for sure, but I will validate anyone's experience because I know what it's like to have yours invalidated.
Stephanie, thank you.
Thank you so much
for being with us. You're listening to the Multiple Sources podcast for Quincy Gideon and Jazz Robertson and our guest, Stephanie Drury. Thank you for listening today, and we will see you next week.